I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Impeachment proceedings in our nation's capital are in full force, and that's a big deal. But many in the Midwest may feel a bit disconnected from them. Today, Missouri Congressman Emanuel Cleaver is here to share what he can about the investigation and to answer your questions about what's going on. We'll also get his views on the Paseo MLK Boulevard issue here at home. Then, Black Americans have historically faced discrimination from banks when trying to get loans, mortgages, and the like. We'll learn about the first Black banks and how vital they are for African American communities. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Once upon a time, Missouri Congressman Emanuel Cleaver was, in his words, extremely apprehensive about impeachment. No longer. The congressman now says he wants history to know where he stood on this question, and where he stands today is a firm conviction that our democracy is being damaged daily. Congressman Emanuel Cleaver has been back in the district visiting with constituents about an issue that now dominates political debate in this country. He joins me now to talk impeachment, where the House is headed, and he'll take your questions too at 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Congressman, always nice to have you here. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
You know, there are a lot of moving parts here in the House's impeachment investigation right now. Is there any doubt in your mind as we stand here today that the president broke the law in his dealings with Ukraine?
I don't think there's any question. And each day we find out with a higher level of certainty that he did, in fact, break the law, because there was a quid pro quo. And the fact that we have people who were now on that phone call, who heard the conversation, saying that it was a quid pro quo, mm-hmm. quo. And actually, the president's chief of staff, Mulvaney, said the same thing on national television. He perhaps didn't intend to do it, but he did. So I think there's no question that he has committed a crime. And I think that what we've got to do in the hearings that are coming up is to get an abundance of evidence to change the minds of independents and maybe even some Republicans. Mm-hmm.
Which laws or law did he break? Do you know yet?
Well, you can't get foreign involvement in the American politics, and it's not so much a political crime as it is a civil crime, because mm-hmm. it's bribery. And so, but if I can, Steve, just the founders were obsessed with foreign interference in the American political process. And now Jefferson was more afraid of German involvement than anybody else, because this was primarily a British colony and then primarily a little republic with mostly British citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And so he thought, well, Germany's going to try to get a foothold here in this government. So at the Constitutional Convention, the discussion was almost daily dealing with foreign interference. And George Mason in 1787 came up with the term high crimes and misdemeanors. And now this was almost an addition to the Constitution. This is in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. A president can be convicted of high crimes and misdemeanors. And so it would go to something like treason, all the way down to some of the things that, well, we've had one Supreme Court justice impeached, and it was for something like having a bad attitude. He was talking to people in what Congress thought in a nasty way.
Mm-hmm.
So they brought it from the highest down to the lowest, But I don't think we're dealing at the low end now. We're dealing at the high end.
But quid pro quos, you're saying, are against the law.
Against the law. You can't do that in government. And you certainly can't. Look, we have a former governor of Illinois in federal prison right now for doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. 15 years. He had a 15-year sentence, Blagojevich.
Mm-hmm.
If people say, well, this is the first time this has ever been done, no, it's not. It's been done over and over and over again.
What disclosure got you to join the pro-impeachment caucus in the House? What was it that tipped you over?
Well, I did this on Fox on the Neil Cavuto show. I actually announced it on the Neil Cavuto show. I had been on the show many times, and I'd said, I'm not real certain about this impeachment thing. Two things happened, both involving Elijah Cummings. One,
the congressman from Maryland who just passed away.
Yes,
yeah,
he's been in Congress 20 something years, absolutely fabulous human being, Phi Beta Kappa, and a good and decent man. The president attacked him and his community. His community has been made famous by this the TV series The Wire.
Mm-hmm.
That's his community. He lives there now. He was born in the house. He lives there now. He lived there until he died. And the president started making fun of the community, saying, this is a community of junk and trash and so mm-hmm. forth. And then attacked Elijah Cummings personally, that he was responsible for it being that way. And then the second part of it was Elijah came on the floor. In his later years, he used the wheelchair and then a little motorized vehicle to get around on it. So he was parked in there as we were voting. And I went to sit by him, which I would do from time to time, and just talk to him about how he was doing. And I said, how are things going in your committee? He was the chair of the Committee on Investigations mm-hmm. and Oversight.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I can't tell you about what's going on because all that is classified in that committee. And he said, but I can tell you, I am now ready to impeach Donald Trump.
Hmm.
And when he said that, I thought, oh, my goodness, because this is not some crazy partisan. I mean, this is a very thoughtful, very spiritual guy. And that's what got me, both the attack on him and then the words he shared with me. And I said, I'm sorry.
Was that a hard call for you?
It was very, very, very difficult because I feared then and I fear today that this will be so disruptive and it's going to be further division in an already, morbidly divided nation.
Right.
And so I didn't want, maybe I'm still Pollyannish, but I didn't want the nation divided any further. And I thought, let's just try to beat the president at the polls. But I can't, my family members were ready for impeachment 5 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can imagine family gatherings, and we have many. So I'm getting beat up by my goddaughters and my own daughter and my other children, and I got to a point where I said, I can't allow my children to see me remaining neutral at a time like this when so much is going on wrong. So I had to do something, when I voted, it was a sad moment. After I voted, I went up. Nancy Pelosi called me. She presided. She rarely presides,
mm-hmm.
but she called me up and she said, right after the vote, I want you to ask for permission to speak out of turn, and I want you to talk to us, the whole Congress, for a short period of time about what we're doing and about not becoming more hostile.
Mm-hmm.
And so several people here were watching it on television, and they noticed that I came up to the microphone and asked to speak, and Pelosi said yes. And then there was an objection. The objection wasn't to me. It was to because laying another piece of legislation on the table, tabling something. But it was so much confusion, I just turned to Steny Hoyer and said, you know, let's not do this now. It's been made even more difficult in here.
Missouri Congressman Emanuel Cleaver is my guest. There were new reports out yesterday that the president asked Attorney General William Barr to hold a news conference and declare that no laws had been broken as a result of his telephone call with Ukraine's president. But Mr. Barr reportedly said no, he wouldn't go along with that. What do you make of that?
Well, this is painful for me to say as well. In the Congress, we are afraid to go to the Attorney General to talk to him about these issues. We are afraid that anything we say to the Attorney General will be transmitted back to the president or to some of the people who are also the objects of investigations.
Mm-hmm.
I think Mr. Attorney General Barr apparently did try to what he did was he did come on TV to say something I can't remember now, but it was not even anything close to what the president wanted. The president wanted him to say the president's that we've looked at this issue and the president's not committed a crime.
Mm-hmm.
But Barr surprisingly didn't say didn't say no to the president. He just didn't do it.
Right.
He just wouldn't.
Yeah, and South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican, said yesterday that it couldn't have been a quid pro quo because the Trump administration's policy towards Ukraine was incoherent and because the administration, I'm quoting here, was, in Lindsey Graham's words, incapable of forming a quid pro quo.
What he was saying was, okay, the people over in the White House are too stupid to do anything. I mean, I mean that was an insult.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we're living in Washington has become a blabbatory,
mm-hmm.
and so maybe that's not a bad thing to insult people. But when Lindsey Graham and Senator McCain were buddies, I had so much respect for both of them, and still do with Mr. McCain, but I don't understand. Lindsey Graham has said he's not even going to read the articles of impeachment.
Yeah.
He said, you know, he's through already.
You know, Congressman, you've been home on recess. What are your constituents saying to you about impeachment and moving ahead here? What kind of collective message are you picking up?
Well, I started out this morning, the first event I attended this morning. That was the first thing the people talked about.
Sure.
I was at a big law firm this morning. It's first thing, impeachment. You know, they want to talk about it. In some parts of my district, I have some farmers, and it's not the majority, so I have to be careful. But I have had some farmers who just said, you know, we don't care about what happened in the Ukraine. You know, we think the president's doing a good job. We want you to support him.
Mm-hmm.
I have been clear everywhere I've gone. There's nobody who doesn't know, you know, that I'm supporting this now. And I moved from non-support to support, and I didn't do it casually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took me a while to get there. But people are talking. I mean, make no mistake, they're talking about it.
Yeah. I assume in the House it's blocking out the sun. Nothing else getting done right now, or am I wrong?
Yeah, there's a lot going on. I mean, I'm on Homeland Security, and we're not getting things done that we should because last Thursday at our last hearing, I spoke to my fifth secretary of Homeland Security. That's five since January.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it was his last day when he was coming before the committee. I don't know if the people in the country realize we cannot have continuity or any kind of, sustained movement toward dealing with Homeland Security issues until we get somebody who's going to be there for, mm-hmm. At least 6 months.
Yeah.
And so it's difficult to get some things done in Homeland Security. But on the financial services side, we're getting some things done. you know, we just had the Bank Secrecy Act approved, which I sponsored.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people go to a bank, the banks are required to provide information to FinCEN, which is an investigatory arm of the Department of Treasury. I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but
right,
anytime somebody deposits $10,000, if it's in cash, it has to be reported immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some things that are happening. I met with Mr. Zuckerberg for about an hour.
The Facebook CEO.
Yes, mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago. And maybe had some impact on his decision. I think he did the right thing by stopping the political ads,
mm-hmm.
Because a lot of them were actually coming from Russia and Iran, at least the money was.
Huh.
And this is not me speaking. This is the FBI, mm-hmm. National Security Agency. And, you know, I don't know if he's going to be able to clean it up without some regulations put in place, but I've told him he needs to do the best he can. But anyway, some things are being done.
Do you think Facebook needs to be, I don't want to get too far astray here, but does Facebook need to be broken up?
A lot of my colleagues want to do it.
Yes.
I mean, I think we need to be very slow and very careful. But they're saying, you know, there's reason for it. You know, we have to break up Ma Bell, and this is bigger than Ma Bell.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
And I've said this to Mr. Zuckerberg, that if you don't come up with something that can satisfy members of Congress, you're going to end up wake up one morning with regulations being taken to the floor for a vote.
Mm-hmm. Congressman Emanuel Cleaver is my guest. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. What is it about this impeachment drama? You know, the American public, you know, clearly is paying attention, but you sort of wonder about the level of engagement here. It's not like it was when Richard Nixon was going through this back in the 70s. And what's the cause of that people aren't as engaged in this whole thing as perhaps you might expect when we're talking about an impeachment of the president of the United States?
Well, I think that's one of the things I've thought about a lot. Look, I do a lot of interviews on CNN and on MSNBC. I will be there this weekend. But also, I was told by some Republicans a couple of weeks ago that I appear on Fox more than any other Democrat. But while I'm going on both Fox and other media outlets, there's a whole group of Americans who only watch Fox,
mm-hmm.
and so for whatever reason, the Fox network will only present certain news. They won't present a lot of the information that's going on, frankly, right now with the president.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a different view. We're creating another whole political culture
because
mm-hmm. they have no idea what's going on. And I know because I talk to some of my farmers, and they'll say, "Well, he hasn't done anything," and I say, "Well, you know, what about the Ukraine? What about the Ukraine?"
Huh.
You know, people don't—they have no idea that it's going on.
Well, this notion of two separate political cultures—that's a scary prospect, isn't it?
Yes,
how do you
it is.
Govern a country that is going in two different directions?
Well, that's why I was hesitant about voting for impeachment, and I think the House is going to probably vote for impeachment, and so that's going to really create the divide
mm-hmm.
because one. If you read an article or see the footage of people at a Trump rally wearing shirts that read, read the transcript, well, all of those folk believe that the transcript has been made available
mm-hmm.
for mm-hmm. what happened with in the Ukraine. We have no transcript. Mm-hmm. Yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have notes on what happened.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so what is the timetable as we move down the road here, Congressman? When do you expect to vote by the full House? What's happening in the meantime? Sort of where are we right now?
I've heard, you know, from some of my colleagues that they want to have some kind of a House vote before the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd like to go a little longer, but I think that's where many of my colleagues are headed. Mm-hmm. They want to get it done this year. Then we open up the next session in January with presenting the articles of impeachment to the Senate.
And in the meantime, what's happening? What other committees are meeting right now to deal with this impeachment question?
Well, we have three committees that are involved: the House Oversight and Committee and Investigation and Oversight. Then you have Judiciary, mm-hmm. Which is the committee that will write the articles of impeachment. And then you have Ways and Means, which is the Tax Committee. Because a lot of this, a lot of things that, you know, that I don't even know about, some I know about, deal with tax issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and so what may be helpful for the audience to know is that I'm not sure whether the speaker wants to put all these things together. It's more than just the Ukraine. There are some other issues as well.
Mm-hmm. So and the focus is you're saying there's more issues on the line here, but Ukraine will be the main focus of the impeachment thrust?
Yes.
Do I have that right?
Yes, almost singularly. Mm-hmm. And for example, we're finding out now because of some other legal action going on in Washington that the president probably lied to Mueller, mm-hmm. which is, of course, a crime.
I just want to point out that Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey has decided that Twitter will not take political ads. Zuckerberg of Facebook says it will continue to take the ads. Just we got flipped around here just a little bit. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. What about if you poll the 5th District of Missouri, Congressman, your district? What would the poll say when it comes to whether the president should be impeached or not?
It would probably be about 60-40.
60-40 is what you're guessing. And is it your thought that by voting to impeach the president, would it be your hope then that the Senate would actually vote to convict him and remove him from office? Is that what your vote represents?
Yes. The House is a grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
And the Senate is actually, you know, the courtroom. This is where the trial will take place,
right,
with the Supreme Court justice presiding. And I don't think, based on what I heard Senator Mitch McConnell say yesterday and Lindsey Graham, that there's any chance for any kind of a conviction.
Okay. Let me go to some phone calls here just quickly in the minutes we have left. Scott from Kansas City, Kansas, good morning.
Hi there. Just real quickly, I agree that the Ukraine incident is an impeachable offense. How do we convince the Trump supporters that this is an impeachable offense?
Well, what I said earlier to Steve is that we have people who are complete. The things we're talking about today, they will never hear this because they only listen to one. It's not a news outlet. One station that mm-hmm. presents what they consider to be facts,
mm-hmm.
even if it comes from Sean Hannity, for example. I'm not sure Sean Hannity is a journalist. He's a radio show. He has a radio show.
Right.
And so it's going to be difficult for both sides to see all of the things that are taking place because they will not read the newspapers, not even the Wall Street Journal. They hate the Wall Street Journal, which produces straight news.
Yeah. Congressman, final question, different topic before you leave here. The Martin Luther King Jr. name was just taken off of street signs along the Paseo. The Paseo name is going to stay. You had favored that change. I'm just wondering, what should happen now? What's the road ahead?
Well, first of all,
it's a tough issue.
It is a tough issue, and we're looking horribly around the nation. I
mm-hmm.
mean, I'm going on one of the national shows this weekend to talk about it. The first call I received yesterday morning was from Congressman Benny Thompson, the chair of Homeland Security, and he didn't even say hello. He said, "What in the world?" This is not his language, but "What in the world is going on in Kansas City?
Yeah.
So we're looking bad nationally, but I think we've got to do something because the NAACP has already put Missouri on the watch list, asking African Americans not to visit Missouri
mm-hmm.
because of the Missouri General Assembly and a lot of things they did. But this is, and I've been asked to meet with him to try to get that Kansas City removed or Missouri removed.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to make it
that much harder.
Yeah, it's not a good deal.
We'll have to leave our conversation there. That's Missouri Congressman Emanuel Cleaver. Congressman, always appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Good to be with you.
After a break, when we come back, we'll talk about the rise in importance of black banks in this country. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, how schools prepare for the ever-present threat of an active shooter on campus. We'll learn why two Kansas City area institutions look at previous incidents around the country to prepare for possible future ones here. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, it's no secret that black people in this country have a harder time getting mortgages and small business loans than whites. And that's not a recent phenomenon. It goes all the way back to colonial times. And it wasn't until after Reconstruction that blacks were able to establish banks that they owned and operated to help other blacks. Well, the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City published a book this year that traces the history of those first black banks, titled Let Us Put Our Money Together, The Founding of America's First Black Banks. It's a great read, and it's actually free. The author is Tim Todd. He's an executive writer for the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, and he joins me now here in the studio. Tim, nice to have you. Welcome.
I'm delighted to be here.
Long before the first black bank was established in this country, African Americans were saving, lending, and borrowing money, but you wonder, how in the world did they do it?
Right. So obviously, in the South, that was a very difficult situation. Individuals were able to, in some cases, hire out their time. A few were able to start small businesses, but it was very rugged and difficult situation, to be sure.
I mean, they were private lenders. Who had enough money in the bank in the black community to lend money to other people?
So there was one individual named, they called him the Barber of Natchez. He was in Natchez, Mississippi, and he had a small business, and he was actually able to lend money to others who came to him looking for assistance.
There were fraternal orders, otherwise known as secret societies. A number of these were burial societies. Why burials involved in dealing with money?
So the first thing is that you wanted to be able to pay, for an appropriate funeral for a loved one or a family member. Mm-hmm. But also there was the view that during a funeral, a burial event, this was a place where black individuals could gather without the white individuals being there, keeping an eye on them. So it was an opportunity to get together and have conversations and spend time together.
There were also what you call rotating credit associations. What are those?
So a rotating credit association is each member of the association puts a small amount in, and then regularly each member will be able to withdraw from that and use those funds. So often in these cases, you are looking to purchase the freedom for yourself or your family member.
You know, Tim, you also stressed the importance of African-American churches in the creation of black banks because of the conventions movement they started. Some 200 conventions were held in various churches during the 1800s. To discuss what?
So the churches were real leaders in the community. They provided a real opportunity for folks to get together. From that, they recognized they had a broader responsibility than just the spiritual aspects. Mm-hmm. And so they had some influence in the community. They had a definite leadership role that could help individuals improve their standing.
You know, eventually the idea of a bank for blacks was proposed at an 1847 convention, and latter ones as well for that matter, but none resulted in an actual bank, and I'm wondering why not.
So obviously, at that time, there was a lot going on. So many of the individuals who were involved in those same discussions about banks were also trying to establish newspapers for the African-American community. They were right. involved in fighting slavery in a lot of different ways. Many were key figures in the Underground Railroad, for instance. And mm-hmm. so in that situation where you're trying to get freedom, the ability to borrow money is a somewhat lower priority.
There were military banks created during the Civil War to handle the pay that black soldiers would receive, but the need for a national bank to handle deposits and unclaimed soldiers' monies was quickly filled by a private group of white New York businessmen, and the Freedmen's Saving and Trust Company was approved by Congress in 1865 as the war was coming to an end. How popular was this bank among blacks, and how quickly did it grow?
So the Freedmen's Bank was basically something that some individuals who had probably their hearts in the right place, felt like we can create this bank and we can lend within the community. We can help individuals. This is after the Civil War get established. But what ends up happening is some white Wall Street connected interests end up basically taking control of this institution. The government's not keeping a close eye on it from a regulatory perspective.
And it was horribly mismanaged.
Horribly mismanaged. There was rampant fraud. The people who eventually assumed control were able to leverage it for their own financial interests. And so about half the depositors ended up getting wiped out when it failed in 1873.
I was going to say there was this panic, this economic panic in 1873. How many people got stiffed when that thing went belly up?
So there was something like 60,000 depositors total. About 30,000 probably got nothing.
Wow. These are folks who needed the money.
Right. So these are folks, this is probably in most cases the only money that these individuals have earned across the span of their entire lives. And it may only be a few dollars, recognize that. So they've really, this money's hugely important to them. What ends up happening is the government goes in, they start selling off what assets the bank has, and they start paying out dividends. This expands over about 10 years. And so if you keep an address on file over about 10 years, you ended up with about 60 cents on the dollar.
Mm. You wonder what happened to those people.
Right. So, and that's 60 cents on the dollar after 10 years being the best case scenario. Many of them got far less.
Hmm. With the end of Reconstruction came the beginnings of the first black banks. Perhaps the one with the grandest name of them all was the Savings Bank of the Grand Fountain, United Order of True Reformers. This was the first chartered black bank. What's the story behind that one, Tim?
So William Washington Brown, who established this bank, he created a group. It was a temperance society and a fraternal organization called the United Order of True Reformers. And they created chapters which were called fountains. One of the fountains was being established, and it was having it had some money in its treasury, but it didn't have anywhere to safely keep it. And so the organizers said, we're going to have to disband. We can't deposit this money in a bank, and there's some risk here. And so there was some discussion, and Brown said, well, hey, why don't we create a bank? This will work for the organization, and then we'll be able to lend to other people in the community and do some other good for the community. So that's the catalyst in its creation.
What state was this in?
This was in Virginia, so the bank was based in Richmond.
I was going to say, how risky was opening a black bank in Confederate-held Virginia?
Right, and so that's
formally
one of the,
held, yeah.
Right, and it's one of the things that was really difficult with the book is that there was so much racial tension going on that when you're writing the book, it sort of could distract from the narrative. So we had to try to balance that out a little bit in the story. But there were definitely significant challenges and risks involved in all these situations.
The first black bank in business was one in Washington, D.C. What kind of banking was that about?
So this was a bank created by some local individuals there in the community who were concerned that black rights were being sort of chipped away at, and they were concerned about the political environment. And so they ran some businesses. One of them was a well-established barber, and they came together and they thought, we can establish this bank. There's a lot of black individuals who work here in government jobs. They'd be perfect to serve with this bank, and we can sort of protect our rights or at least create additional economic opportunity by the lending we do, things like that.
How well did it do?
It did pretty well. Actually, all these early banks, all the early black banks actually did really well in comparison to their peers. So in this era in U.S. history is very tumultuous. A bank might only last 5 to 7 years. And all of the earliest generation of black banks averaged around 20 years as far as their lifespan.
I was going to say, at their height, do we know how many black banks there were operating in the country?
So from this earliest period, which starts in the late 1800s, eventually as you move into the early 1900s, you end up with more than 50 banks and then all sorts of other types of institutions involved in lending or other types of financial services.
So how easy was it for black folks to get credit to be able to use the services of a bank back then?
Right. So it made it a lot easier. A lot of these banks were focused on, they were particularly innovative as you think of things like home lending and how do you structure a home loan in a way that an individual can pay for it. So they were looking at things like that. Definitely created a lot of opportunity for folks.
So back then, you were saying at the height, there were 50, you're saying?
There were probably more than 50 eventually.
Today, there are 22 black banks in this country, and blacks still struggle with getting loans and lines of credit. strikes me as we're not making the kind of the trajectory, the bar graph wouldn't suggest great progress here.
Right. So if you look at the history right now and you look at other categories of what we call MDIs, which are minority depository institutions, you will see that if we're looking in the Hispanic area, for example, there are more banks today than there were in 2000. The trend in the African-American community has been the other way. We have about half as many as we had in 2000.
And that would be why?
So one of the things that happened is African-American neighborhoods were hit particularly hard with foreclosures after the financial crisis. And so that—
Of 2008.
So if you look at the chart, you will actually see that. You will see a decline there after 2008. So there have been some failures. There have been some mergers and acquisitions also. In some cases, those were by black banks. In some cases, they were not by black banks.
Do African-American leaders tend to believe there's still a great need for black banks in this country?
Well— from my perspective, I certainly believe there are a great need for these banks, particularly community banks that lend within the local community.
Mm-hmm. One of those black banks that currently operates in the country is called the Liberty Bank, Tim. It started in New Orleans, and it grew from there, including branches in both Kansas cities here. Tell listeners what Liberty Bank did in the aftermath of Katrina down in New Orleans.
Yeah, so Liberty actually here in Kansas City acquired earlier in the 2000s, acquired Douglas, what used to be Douglas State Bank, which was based in Kansas City, Kansas. And today, Liberty's on both sides of the state line, just about a block north of us here at the studios. One of the things they did after Katrina in 2005 is Alden McDonald, the president there, he decided that we're going to allow individuals, because they need cash, they can withdraw up to $500 from an ATM, even though we don't have any way of knowing if they have the money in their accounts.
Mm-hmm.
He did other things like extended grace periods on loans, recognizing that people didn't have access to their jobs, they didn't have access to their homes. So he received quite a bit of attention and notoriety. The New York Times followed him pretty closely in the aftermath of Katrina, the types of things he was doing and continues to do in the New Orleans community.
Huh. Are the black banks of today as vital to their communities as those first black banks were to theirs?
I tend to think so. And I think that one of the things as you sort of look at the environment today is you've seen this decline in the number of black banks. If we also did a chart and talked about households outside the banking system, you would see that black households are more likely to be either totally outside the banking system, or maybe they have a checking account, but they might be borrowing money from like a payday lender or someone who may be offering exploitive terms to them.
So that's a huge problem. We've talked about that any number of times.
That is a very big problem, and it's disproportionate to the black community versus other groups.
So what can the Federal Reserve do to encourage the creation of more black banks, or can it do much of anything?
So there's a lot of initiatives that the bank regulators do. The Fed has something called Partnership for Progress, where you can go online, you can learn about some of the things we're doing there. Here at the Kansas City Fed, we thought it was important to get this history out to sort of contribute to this dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
This is a history a lot of people are unaware of. So you may have heard of the Freedmen's Bank and know some things about it, but you probably don't know about William Brown, one of the individuals we talk about, or some of these other folks who were real innovators and real leaders in their communities.
Yeah, I was going to say, we talk about lots of issues on this show, but the notion of the dearth of black banks, that's not one we've spent a lot of time with. And you're pointing out here that your history suggests it's something that we need to have on our radar screens.
Yeah, it's definitely significant. Overall in the United States, the number of community banks, smaller institutions, have been declining for a very long time, but the decline in the African-American community has been much more significant.
Have you seen any attempts to start a new black bank here in Kansas City in recent years?
There is nothing that I'm aware of. There have been some things where if you go online, you can see people thinking about maybe creating, you know, online type of institutions or something along those lines. I'm not quite sure how that would work out.
What's it take to start a bank?
Well, you've got to have some money and some investors and some capital to lend out, and then you have to go through a process there to create an institution to get your charter.
Well, if it's lots of money, I'm not the right guy to help do that, I don't think. But well, I want to thank Tim Todd for coming in, executive writer for the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. His new book, Let Us Put Our Money Together, The Founding of America's First Black Banks. Where can people get that book, Tim?
Hey, they can go to the Kansas City Fed's website, kansascityfed.org. The book is free. We will be happy to send them to you.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks so much for your time today. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and some fun stuff to do this weekend, including Kris Kristofferson.
On the Sunday morning sidewalk, wishing the Lord. something named a Sunday. Makes a body feel alone. There ain't nothing short of dying. On the sleeping city sidewalk, Sunday morning coming down.
That's the voice of the legend Kris Kristofferson, and he'll be here tonight at the Uptown Theater. Brian McTavish is here to talk about some fun stuff to do here over the weekend in Kansas City. Welcome back. How are
you?
Nice to have you.
It's great to be here.
The legend's here. He's here in town.
He's got to be here unless he's getting here late. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tonight, 8 o'clock, Uptown Theater. Get the good fun time weekend. Although, you know, I'm not sure this is a good time fun song. Sunday morning coming down. His songs tended to dwell in the land of, lost hopes and shattered dreams and and that sort of thing. Basically, he is a truly iconic songwriter.
Yes, he is. One of the great ones. That's what the country music by Ken Burns said. He's one of the great ones.
As a matter of fact, next week's Country Music Awards ceremony in Nashville will honor him, but Kristofferson won't be there. He'll be on the road plying his craft. I really urge you to go tonight to the Uptown Theater. I mean, take this song, Sunday Morning Coming Down. It's a song that he convinced Johnny Cash to record in 1970.
Wow.
What did it take? Well, he was a helicopter pilot, so Kristofferson lands a helicopter in Cash's front yard and makes his case to the man in black face to face.
Is that right?
That is absolutely right.
Kristofferson told the most wrenching story in that country music series by Burns, saying how his parents were embarrassed about him, wrote him a letter, just basically said, we're ashamed of you for being a musician. And then Cash came in and saw him a couple days later and said, hey, Chris, always hard to get a letter from home, isn't it? Just a great
story.
Well,
the thing is, no matter how sad...
Sad story.
Well, no matter how sad things get in his songs like Me and Bobby McGee and Help Me Make It Through the Night and Loving Her Was Easier Than Anything I'll Ever Do Again, between the lines, there's always this remote hope for redemption, which I guess is implicit in the sharing of these deep feelings. Mm. There's always the possibility in his songs of rising up and moving on to maybe, just maybe, Steve, a better day. And that is genius songwriting, man.
There's still Kris Kristofferson tickets available tonight.
There are.
8 o'clock tonight at the Uptown.
Yes.
Always liked that song. Always liked it. But we're talking about Jason Sudeikis is going to be in town, also at the Uptown.
Okay. Some people are satisfied with banging gongs like T-Rex. How about a thunder gong? I'll take that as a yes. Okay. So you'll want to check out Jason Sudeikis and friends who are once again presenting the annual Thunder Gong at 8 o'clock Saturday night, yes, at the Uptown Theater. So be there. Thunder Gong is the comedy variety show and fundraiser for the Steps of Faith Foundation. Steps of Faith provides prosthetic care to uninsured people who are amputees. So, Sudeikis, many of us know, some of us may not know, but he is from Kansas City, a proud graduate of Shawnee Mission West High School. I live just down the street. When I walk around that high school, I think, wow. Let me touch the locker that he... I wonder if his locker is commemorated. Anyway, he became a star on Saturday Night Live and all that. So, Thunder Gong performers are subject to change, but the many fun people there include SNL alumni Fred Armisen and Will Forte.
Wow.
Country star Wynonna Judd of the Judds and her husband Cactus Moser, the Get Up Kids, Ben Harper, Derek Hughes, stand-up magician, by the way, and Kansas City yacht rock band Summer Breeze. It looks to be quite a show for a very, very worthy cause.
8 o'clock Saturday night at the Uptown.
Yes, sir.
Well, show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Don't ask why. Show me the way.
What do we have here?
Well, you can go from whiskey bar to whiskey bar, or you can just show up at Pig and Swig, the barbecue, bourbon, bacon, and don't forget the Whiskey Fest. It also has live tunes, lawn games, and yes, a mechanical bull from 3 to 6 Saturday. Where else but 13th and Grand, downtown Kansas City, Power and Light District. Pick and Squeak, what else do you need to know? Well, let me tell you. Barbecue and bacon from 7 vendors. Bourbon samples at, get this, Swig stations.
Whoa.
Indeed.
Whoa.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of that.
Dozens
of different bourbon and whiskey brands to choose from. Although subject to change, the event's website indicates that close to 50 varieties of whiskey and bourbon will be available. Now, if you are a general admission ticket holder, then you get 10 bourbon tasting tokens. If you're a VIP ticket holder, you get 20 bourbon tasting tokens, which would suggest perhaps more than enough bourbon tasting tokens.
Okay.
Have fun with all of that.
That sounds like fun. What do we got?
Oh, we got a little bit of Billie Holiday. There she is. Them their eyes.
Is.
That's right. She's part of Harlem 100, her memory and her music. It's the concert multimedia tribute to musicians, singers, and dancers of the Harlem Renaissance.
Wow.
7 o'clock Sunday at the Carlson Center at Johnson County Community College. It's in collaboration with the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. And, you know, artists like Billie Holiday, Duke Ellington, Fats Waller, Bessie Smith, they'll all be represented. The touring band Michael Mwenso and the Shakes, they're hosting. But there will be, my gosh, guest vocalists of great renown and expert tap dancer Michaela Marino Lerman. That's Harlem 100 Sunday at the Carlson Center.
And finally today, like that song too.
Everybody.
And Tommy's going to be here. Tommy Two-Tone.
Yes. Tommy Two-Tone, including original band member, the band's namesake and original lead singer, Tommy Heath. He's still on stage with Tommy Two-Tone.
Wow.
Be there. It's the 80s one-hit wonder band that still has its fans' number.
Wow.
You like that?
Yeah.
8 o'clock.
Yes, it is.
8
yes,
o'clock
you do.
Friday.
867-5309.
No, it's 867-5309.
No.
Nyeying. That's the ticket.
Okay.
You got to check it out. If you were there in the early 80s, I worked at a record store. Everybody wanted that record.
There you go.
Have fun.
You live through it. That's Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Yesterday in the show, former Senator Claire McCaskill said she's enjoying her new role as a political analyst for NBC News. Hear her predictions for the 2020 election and other up-to-date episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/up-to-date. On Friday, Michael Stern has helped take the Kansas City Symphony from so-so to well-known, but he's closing in one of his last years as musical director. We'll learn about his plans to continue the orchestra's artistic excellence. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up-to-Date. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.